On Radio Australia, this is Asia Pacific. I'm Kanahasa Babathi. Coming up, Peter O'Neill says he's in total control of Papua New Guinea. And asylum seeker policy, once again a topic of debate in Australia. But first, urgent diplomacy has been taking place since the news of the death of North Korea's leader Kim Jong-il. The leaders of the United States, Japan and South Korea have called for a peaceful leadership transition and could meet in the near future. The U.S. says it's also talking with China and Russia, the other nations involved in stalled talks on the North's nuclear program. The new regime's attitude to any resumption of the six-party talks remains unknown at this point, but aid groups are calling for a resumption of humanitarian assistance as a sign of goodwill. Karen Snowden reports.
President Barack Obama has spoken with his South Korean counterpart and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton with Japan's foreign minister.
We both share a common interest in a peaceful and stable transition in North Korea, as well as in ensuring regional peace and stability. We have been in close touch with our partners in the six-party talks today.
Those talks, now stalled for 3 years, might be slow to get restarted. No one knows. Analysts say recent months of negotiations had the US set to announce, perhaps this week, the resumption of food aid to the North in return for nuclear concessions from Pyongyang. Kwon Man-hak is professor in international relations at Kyunghee University in Seoul.
They were discussing, and it was almost determined that before Kim Jong-il died, in return for their return to the preliminary 6-to-6-party talks.
Significantly, the U.S. planned to send 20,000 tons of nutritional supplements a month, and not rice or other grains. These can be easily stolen by the army or stockpiled by the leaders. The great successor, Kim Jong-un, and his late father have never looked like they know what it's like to miss a meal, unlike many of the North's citizens. Undeveloped agriculture, state control of food supplies and just plain bad weather all contribute to low food production and ongoing hunger. The UN's World Food Programme reported in November severe food shortages have persisted this year and 32% of children were stunted because of poor nutrition. A spokesperson said the organisation wouldn't comment for this report because of the political sensitivity of the issue at this time. Several other groups joined the UN in its assessment of the North's need for aid, including World Vision, whose spokesman is Dean Owens.
World Vision and other groups are hopeful that the change in leadership there will not interrupt our ongoing efforts that are in the country, again, those programs. But anybody who speculates on what's going to happen outside of the leadership of that country, it's only speculation. No one truly, truly knows.
World Vision believes food aid should be kept separate from the political negotiations.
We believe that a hungry child knows no politics.
Professor Kwon Man-hak says the priority for the US and its allies is the stabilization of the peninsula, so they might even make Pyongyang a better offer.
So I would say they would continue and implement the agreements they had with North Korea, and probably plus they might add the food grains and increase such incentives for North Korean leaders, whoever they are, they're in flux, but for them to take. I think that's the measure and the right direction for the United States.
Professor Kwon says the immediate focus for the other major player, China, will be on getting to know the new leadership in Pyongyang.
For the Chinese, they have another main goal, that getting the next leadership on their side. Already they are, China is the country that provides largest aid to North Korea, including food and energy. So in addition to that, probably they will provide political assistance if possible, and probably they will give some kind of military assurances to North Koreans, I guess, to gain support of the next leadership.
Professor Kwon Man-hak from South Korea's Kyunghee University, ending Karen Snowden's report. Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister Peter O'Neill says he will be introducing changes to legislation to ensure political standoffs like the one with former Prime Minister Sir Michael Somare does not happen again. Sir Michael is still insisting he is the legal Prime Minister, basing his claim on a ruling from the Supreme Court. But Mr. O'Neill told Pacific Beat's Bruce Hill that he is in total control of the country.
The courts in this country have got no powers to order the parliament to install a prime minister. Sir Michael continues to have minority numbers on the floor of parliament. Parliament has not mandated him to run the country. The Supreme Court or the courts of our country can only make references back to parliament to correct itself. Now, we have taken note of the court orders. We have accepted the court orders in parliament. We have debated on it and we have disposed of it. We now have introduced legislation to correct the process. And the process is that any person holding the office of the Prime Minister who is away for an extended period of time, over 3 months, in fact automatically vacates that office. In line with that, the Parliament has taken note that there has been a vacancy and a new Prime Minister has been elected. This has now been recognized by all sectors of the community. Almost 90% of our people support that. In fact, the public servants are now fully behind, and the Governor General yesterday admitted to the fact that he was wrongly advised by people who had no right to advise him, and as a result, we have been duly sworn in, and we are now in total control of the country.
So is there still basically a clash between these two principles of control of Parliament and rule of law? Is the Supreme Court falling into line, though? Will you have to go back to the Supreme Court to get them to somehow publicly acknowledge this?
I mean, Parliament is not answerable to the Supreme Court. If anybody feels aggrieved by any decision Parliament has taken, of course they have every right to go to court for an interpretation. Again, Somare and his camp have got every right to go and exercise their constitutional right and go to court, and if they feel aggrieved, that they can seek an interpretation, which court will interpret and report back to Parliament, and Parliament will continue to correct itself.
The people who supported Sir Michael Somare, apparently in good faith, adhering to this principle of rule of law, is anything bad going to happen to them as a result of them supporting Sir Michael Somare, or do you understand their reasons for doing what they did?
Nobody is operating outside the rule of law. That includes our government. We are subject to the constitution of our country, acts of parliament that we introduce on the floor of parliament. And I want to state to everybody that the country, despite the crisis, have been able to operate in a very orderly manner. Our citizens have gone about with their lives in an orderly manner. There has been no riots. There has been peaceful protests supporting our government. But that is a constitutional right. So all in all, I think Papua New Guineans have expressed great maturity in ensuring that our country's democracy prevails.
Sir Michael Somare, the father of PNG, took the country to independence, a very long and distinguished career. Is this really the way that his political career should be brought to an end, though, on this note?
Well, this is not by choice. You know, Sir Michael Somare has done this to himself. This country belongs to 7 million people. We acknowledge his contribution to the country. We have great respect for the contributions that he has made. But he clearly knows that he is not healthy. He does not have the public support. He does not have Parliament's support, and certainly he does not have the business community and international community support. So it is quite obvious the writing is on the wall. He needs to retire gracefully with dignity and the respect that he deserves.
PNG Prime Minister Peter O'Neill speaking to Bruce Hill. Philippines President Benigno Aquino has pledged to help the survivors of the devastating tropical storm Washi to rebuild their lives. He also declared a state of national calamity after the devastating floods and landslides at the weekend claimed more than 1,000 lives and injured 1,500 others. Commander Edgardo Olet is chief of the Operations Center at the Philippines National Disaster Risk Reduction Management Council, and he told Tracy Hutchison the declaration of national calamity will help coordinate the massive relief effort.
The declaration of state of calamity was issued by the Office of the President of the Philippines. It's because of the offer of many countries who have diplomatic ties with the Philippines to offering their assistance for the affected communities. And this will facilitate the bringing in of humanitarians and disaster relief from different countries.
There are reports, sir, that the risk of disease is great with lack of adequate food and shelter, particularly water, available potable water. What can you tell us about that?
Right now, the national and the local government in the affected areas, they have to sustain the release of bottled drinking water because the whole area was submerged underwater by flash floods. And definitely the water is contaminated. Some of our water treatment equipment coming from Manila had been shipped earlier, I think 2 to 3 of them. So we continuously look for water purification treatment plant or equipment that can be shipped towards the area so that we will have a very long-term way of dealing for the day-to-day needs of their potable drinking water rather than the bottled water. But we still welcome bottled water because that's the easiest way they can use for now. Then the other one are the handling of mass casualties, the dead bodies. I think there is already the danger of health issues because they are already in the advanced state of decomposition.
And finally, sir, what's your most immediate concern at the moment?
I focus on about food packs, bottled drinking water, food, and then some non-food items like blankets and mosquito net and slippers and some toys for the children, part of their, you know, addressing their trauma in their early age, because most of the inhabitants have lost totally their houses.
Commander Edgardo Olet from the Philippines National Disaster Risk Reduction Management Council speaking there to Tracy Hutchison. On Radio Australia, you're listening to Asia Pacific. Australia's asylum seeker policy is once again being a hotly debated topic following the weekend tragedy when a boat with asylum seekers sank off the east coast of Java. 49 people are known to have survived, but more than 150 people are still thought to be missing. The government has released several letters it's written to the opposition leader Tony Abbott, urging him to join discussions aimed at coming to a compromise on offshore processing. But the opposition says unless the government puts forward a more concrete proposal, discussions would be pointless. Stephen Jedgetts reports from Canberra.
The Immigration Minister Chris Bowen says it's a reasonable request. He wants to meet with the Coalition's immigration spokesman, Scott Morrison, and reach an agreement on how to process asylum seekers overseas.
I'm not a scary man. I don't see why Mr. Abbott is so scared of letting Mr. Morrison into a room with me to see if a mutually agreed outcome can be negotiated. We agree on offshore processing. We agree it's necessary. Surely it shouldn't be too hard.
The government wants to resurrect its Malaysia asylum seeker deal, but it needs support from the Coalition or the Greens to get legislation through Parliament. The opposition says asylum seekers should only be sent to countries that have signed the Refugee Convention. That excludes Malaysia, but would permit the Coalition's preferred option, which is Nauru. Mr. Bowen says he's willing to compromise with the Coalition to re-establish offshore processing, but he's reiterated his criticisms of Nauru and won't say what other proposals he'd be willing to consider. Neither will the acting Prime Minister Wayne Swan, who's also trying to ratchet up the pressure on Mr. Abbott.
Getting the wrecking ball out and smashing everything isn't leadership. The fact is that we decided to ask the opposition to sit down and constructively have a discussion.
For the moment, the opposition isn't blinking. Scott Morrison says it's unfortunate the government's decided to make its offer of talks public.
I think the government is trying to provide a smokescreen to avoid the need to actually deal with the hard discussions they have to have internally about how they fix this mess.
He says the coalition is willing to talk about offshore processing, but the government must first put forward a concrete proposal for it to consider.
And so it's not unreasonable for the coalition to simply say, make us an offer, put something on the table, and we'll talk about it. But until then, this is a hollow gesture.
Mr. Swan has rejected that.
No, but I don't think we should be putting parameters around the discussion. The Australian public really do expect us to sit down and to work our way through this issue.
The standoff is frustrating several religious leaders. The Australian Christian Lobby's Jim Wallace says there needs to be a bipartisan agreement to re-establish offshore processing.
We had Labor play with this in a politically opportunistic way during 2007 election. We've now got the coalition playing with it for political reasons. And we need both to get together and come up with a solution to this. We can't have people dying in the gap like this.
And the Howard government's Foreign Minister, Alexander Downer, says the coalition should sit down and negotiate with the government.
Wayne Swan as the acting Prime Minister and Tony Abbott should organise their two teams to sit down in a mature and constructive way and nut out a solution to this to establish a new offshore processing facility.
Other Liberal luminaries disagree. The former Industrial Relations Minister, Peter Reith, says calling in the opposition is one of the oldest tricks in the book of political defences.
Stephen Jedgett's reporting. The strategic transformation in Asia over the last 20 years has been phenomenal, with the return of Asian powers like China and India to the scene. But while this has been happening, Japan appears to have stalled, which, according to a report from the independent think tank, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, has led to Tokyo slipping off the radar when it comes to Canberra's strategic thinking. One of the institute's directors, Dr. Rod Lyon, says increasingly Australia is looking towards India, China and the US. But he says despite Japan's stagnation, it has the capacity to play a greater economic and defence role in the region. Dr. Lyon is speaking here to Michael Kavanagh.
Australia usually underestimates India. But I guess over the past year or two, there's been a body of evidence that says we're starting to revalue the Indian relationship. We've certainly taken China's growth on board, and the US is our traditional partner. Japan just seemed to us to be the country that was now beginning to slip off the radar. Partly that's because it's a stalled power, partly because it's an introverted one.
Well, the Australian government's presently looking at what it describes as the Asia Century. Australia's recently hosted US President Barack Obama, and during that trip, the Australia-US alliance was expanded with more US troops in Australia's north. There's no doubt that this was done to counter China's growing influence in the region. Doesn't this also point to the US and Australia wanting Japan to play a greater role?
I think the Obama trip was mainly about reassuring Australia, but I do think that when we look at the speed of strategic transformation in Asia, you're looking at two interrelated factors. The first factor is that the US role is shrinking a little bit because US primacy is now more contested in the region. Partly that's got to do with weaknesses the US is encountering at home and how widespread at the global level its burdens still remain. The second factor, the interrelated factor, is the return of Asian great powers to the international system. As those great powers come back, we are going to see a more multipolar Asian security environment. For us, the speed of that transformation has actually been quite striking over the past 20 years. And if you look forward the next 20, what you can see is that quite a bit of the shape of the new Asian century will be determined by events that take place in that 20-year period. And Australia and I think other regional countries don't want that formative shape to be undertaken or that formative shape to be unpacked while Japan is weakened and extroverted. Japan has a role to play in that system and we should be encouraging it to be an active player there.
How can it be an active player when you take into account that power these days is very much linked to economic growth? Japan's own economy has wallowed for nearly two decades. How can it still maintain that influence if it is seen as falling by the wayside in other areas?
On an economic growth indicator, it's not going to be competitive with the rapidly rising powers of India and China. Its power comes from its current size. Even today, the third largest economy, the Asia-Pacific region, it has that position even though it's been through a period of economic stagnation for the better part of 20 years. It's a stalled power, but stalled at a high level. So it has capacity to play a bigger role in an economic sense. I think it also has capacity to play a bigger role in a sheer defence sense. Although it only spends 1% of its GDP on its defence force, its economy is so large that still gives it a modern effective military force.
In all of this, the events in North Korea with the death of its leader, Japan's always been very aware of its location and the Korean Peninsula. How would the Japanese leadership be viewing these events?
They will be anxious, but they have very few cards to play in shaping the outcomes in Pyongyang. Like other regional neighbours of North Korea, they're anxious not because I think they suspect that there's going to be a sudden new adventurism in North Korean military policy, but they're anxious because they would like to be reassured that a stable succession is on the cards. There will be one clear decision maker in Pyongyang, and that decision maker will have a firm control of North's plutonium and other nuclear assets.
Dr. Rod Lyon, Director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, speaking there to Michael Kavanagh. New treatment is being developed to combat one of the oldest and most debilitating tropical diseases, commonly known as elephantiasis. The disease is spread by mosquitoes and causes severe disfigurement, which can lead to permanent disability. More than 70 million people in Southeast Asia are affected with the disease, and current treatment involves long periods of chemotherapy. Dr. Robert Don from the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative, which is developing the new treatment, told Senlam the disease affects the body in several ways.
You have a worm which infects the body through the mosquito, as you said, and that worm matures in what's called the lymphatic system. And once it does it there, it causes enormous swelling, or can cause enormous swelling of the lymphatic system, which can lead to the symptoms of elephantiasis, which you've seen, many people may have seen, which is the grossly swollen legs and arms, and often in men also grossly swollen genitals.
So the infection enters the body through a worm, and where does the worm come from? What spreads it?
The worm is actually spread from other people. So you have in the infected people, you have adult worms, just a few of them, maybe half a dozen or more, which live in the lymph system, and they produce thousands and thousands of juveniles or baby worms, which get into the bloodstream. And they're picked up by mosquitoes and transmitted from one person to another. And once they get into the next person, they mature, they go back to the lymph system, mature, and turn into adult worms and repeat the cycle.
So 70 million people are afflicted in Southeast Asia alone. Why is this disease so rampant?
It's an old disease that has simply been around for a long time, and there are very poor controls, or until recently, until about 10 years ago, no really effective treatments and very poor controls in terms of preventing the spread of it.
So tell us about this new treatment option that's being developed by the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative.
Mm-hmm. Well, currently the treatment is actually not a treatment. It's called mass drug administration, and everyone who is potentially at risk is given one tablet once a year, which kills the juvenile or the baby worms, and that stops the worms from spreading from one person to the next. And this has continued for several years until the adult worms die of a natural cause in the normally infected people. What we're looking at is a drug that kills the adult worms. So instead of treating several times for many years, we hope we can reduce that to 1 or 2 years.
So you hope to stop it at the source, as it were?
Pretty much, yeah, exactly.
So are these treatments currently available, or are you still fine-tuning it?
We're still in the development stage, so we're still fine-tuning, we're still looking at ways of improving and making it effective. So it'll be a few years off yet.
So what are the social and economic impact, if you like, of infection of elephantiasis? I imagine people who are afflicted would find it very difficult to work.
They do indeed. I mean, there's a lot of rejection in society, or failure to accept the people in society. They're also debilitated in the sense that it's very difficult for them to conduct, you know, a lot of the normal village work and village life. So they tend to be, I wouldn't say a burden, but they're certainly less productive. And with the numbers that are infected, it has a huge impact on the economic viability of communities in those regions.
Dr. Robert Don from the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative speaking to Senlam from Brisbane. And that's all from Asia Pacific for today. I'm Kanahasa Babathi. Join me again tomorrow for Asia Pacific.